Sarah.
And I'm PJ.
And this is What the
Parent.
What the Parent. Brought to you by Talkative Children. Talkative Children. Do you have talkative children at home? There is a certain age where it's prime time talkative children.
Well, there's an age where you're like, are you ever going to talk? Please.
Please say something. Say something. First words. First sentences.
Oh, it's look how cute. Look at their little voices. And then quickly that turns to, oh my God, can I get a break?
Yeah. Are you going to take a breath from that sentence? I mean, you're just telling me about your stuffed animal. You're telling me about what happened. You're telling me about this color, coloring book.
I know.
Like, woo.
And then it morphs into, oh, you're just not talking to me at all. Now it's just not even full sentences. It's just one word. Hey, how was school? Fine. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Hello. Waving in front of them. Hello.
I know.
I'm here. Hello. Remember I used to be cool?
No, yeah. The only word you get from them is awkward. Awkward. Well, there's nothing awkward about the show today because speaking of talking and language, we have Viorica Marion. She's the author of the Power of Language.
She's amazing.
Yes. Yeah. It's awesome. Apparently, you know, being bilingual or multilingual is a superpower. She's going to tell us how that is.
She is Captain Marvel or Mrs. Marvel or whatever you want to call her for languages. She is all over it. Her linguistic capabilities are astounding.
Yes. She's a psychologist, a researcher, writer. She's the Ralph and Jean Sundin Endowed Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. She's got all the credentials.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad I know her because I have no credentials. So it helps me, you know, feel a little bit better just hanging out with her.
Our IQ just goes up.
Yeah. Well, people think my IQ goes up, which is great. I'll take that every day.
Yeah.
But fascinating conversation with her about how language can really help mold children for the future. And you guys are going to learn a lot. We learned a lot.
Yeah.
And looking forward to sharing her with you. So without further ado, let's meet Viorica. But just before we get to all of that, wanted to talk about the fact that we have two sponsors this season.
Two sponsors.
And actually,
two.
They're us.
That's right.
And what I mean by that is, first sponsor is...
Skip to the Good Part.
Is Skip to the Good Part, which is a podcast that Kara and I are on because Kara is a lifelong author, over 35 books to her credit. And on Skip to the Good Part, we get to interview awesome romance, rom-com, and other authors.
Yeah.
To learn about them, to learn about their secrets.
Secrets.
Their secrets. Deep secrets. Yes, we learn about that.
No, it's really like, yes, yeah. How did you become a writer? And what things do you like to write? Well,
what's your process? So check out Skip to the Good Part on pretty
wherever
much all
get
the...
Your podcast.
Wherever you're finding this one.
That's right.
Second one is shipwithpj.com.
That's right. Do you ship things?
Do you move freight? Imports, exports, domestic, small
do you need
package?
Warehousing?
Less than truckload, full truckload, pallets.
Is your logistics causing you headaches?
If it is, and you need warehousing and distribution, you need any kind of strategies, you need any kind of go to market, anything in regards to logistics, go to shipwithpj.com.
That's right. He has a lifelong experience in logistics.
I do, 33 years.
That's right.
So, love helping people out. Love getting people not to worry about freight focused on their sales and marketing
exactly.
And creating great products for people to share. So,
we'll handle the headaches. Don't worry.
Come check us out at shipwithpj.com as well as
Skip to the Good Part.
Skip to the Good Part. Thanks so much. And now to the interview.
Viorica, welcome. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us about this new book, The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. Tell us a little about the book for people who might not know.
Sure. So the book is about the interaction between language and mind, how the languages we speak shape our minds and our brains as people at the individual level, but also as a society. So I am a psycholinguist, and psycholinguistics is a field at the intersection of psychology and linguistics. It studies the psychology of language. My own area of expertise is bilingualism and multilingualism. So the book is written from the perspective of bilingualism and multilingualism and learning a second or third or a new language and how that changes us throughout the lifespan.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
And is it, it's any language, right? So in other words, like there isn't one particular language that's more beneficial to know than another.
Right. It really is about any language. And not only that, but the book goes beyond natural languages and talks about language in a broader sense. So including artificial languages, including mathematics, including music, any kind of code that humans use to encode, transmit, and then decode information.
Yeah.
So if I am proficient and fluent in profanity, that helps.
is that a specific code?
Well, you know what? It's funny that you mentioned that because I actually talk about that a little bit in the book. And the things that I talk about when I talk about profanity, there are a couple of times I mention it. One is that, you know, there is a powerful effect of language and words. And there is actually research that finds that when we use profanity, it can decrease the stress that we experience. So, for example, in one study, people would hold their hand in icy cold water, like uncomfortably, painfully cold. And if they were swearing along the way when they were doing it, they were able to hold their hand in the water for longer.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, next time you step a toe on your kid's Legos, you can let it fly.
That's and Oh, and sometimes I do. I don't mean to, but sometimes it comes out anyway.
Yeah, well, those experiments are not my, like they're not done in my lab. They're done by other people who study a language. But yes, so that's one area that I go into a little bit. And then another area, since PJ asked about profanity, is that in bilinguals, when you test their reaction to curse words, they have a stronger reaction in their native language than in their second language. So if you finish a galvanic skin response, which basically would involve putting sensors on someone's skin and measuring the response of their nervous system when, you know, you call their mother words or you send them places. If you do that in their native language, they have a stronger reaction, which is also something you can sort of keep in mind practically when you're traveling to another country and someone is getting on your nerves and you start cursing in your native language, thinking that, well, they don't understand me. You should keep in mind that that's probably going to rattle you more than them because you're in your native language. So not sure how
right.
much
your stress is going to go up way more than theirs.
Right.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. I wonder, is that because we grow up with those words being taboo for us? There's a lot of emotional charge to them. Maybe.
Bingo. Mm-hmm. Right. You're exactly right, Kara. So our native language is acquired most often during childhood in this rich emotional environment and is connected to all sorts of emotions and memories and feelings and identity. And when we use that language, it activates that entire frame of reference more.
Sure.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And right. Especially, yeah, if we learn another language, you know, as teenagers or adults, there's less of that emotional encoding, I guess, with us because we're more objective and neutral. It's just a word versus, you know, it's something I got in trouble for saying when I was five.
You know? Yeah.
And of course, it depends how you learn the language. If you learn it in the classroom in a really sort of setting that's devoid of any kind of emotional input, then you are less likely to have those emotional affiliations. But if you do learn it, maybe from a partner or when you live in another country, you'll still have some emotional connection. They'll just be different than the ones in your native language. And people really vary in how strong their emotional associations are and whether they are positive or negative with the first versus the second language, depending on the kind of experiences that language evokes.
Interesting.
What if you learned bad language from your parents, but they said it wrong?
Oh, PJ has an experience with this.
care to share the experience?
Yeah.
So
psychoanalyze it from
yes,
there.
Yes.
Please psychoanalyze away. I mean, do we have enough time? Jeez. So my mom was born and raised in Hawaii, and she was half Chinese. And so when I was growing up, she would drop Chinese interspersely here and there, as a matter of conversation. And then, you know, of course, growing up, I wanted to know how to swear in Chinese. And so, you know, she said, okay, well, one thing you can say is, sifat lao cheng. I'm like, okay, what does that mean? And she says that means your rear end has worms. I'm like, okay, that's gross. And I don't know why that's a swear thing.
Yeah, all right.
And she said, well, it's because it's a class insult. Like if you have worms, then you're not rich enough or you don't make enough money to eat food that isn't rotten. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, all right. I guess that makes sense. So fast forward to when I'm in Hong Kong as an adult, and I am one of the things that I used to love to do, because I'm always interested in languages, is when I would travel, I would like to learn how to say the same thing in all different languages. So one thing that I used to like to learn was how to say that ain't right, because I don't know.
It can come in handy in any number of places.
Especially sure. When you're negotiating, if someone says something, you're like, that ain't right. So I don't know. So when I was in Canton, or when I was in Hong Kong, and I'm like, you know, how do you say that ain't right in Cantonese? And they say, okay, so it's like, pudoi. I'm like, all right. And how do you say, and then for whatever reason, excuse me for swearing here, but I said, well, how do you say rat bastard? And they said, well, there's no translation for that.
Yeah, we don't have anything for that. Yeah.
I was like, all right, well, and they go, well, you know, there is sifat lo, which kind of means like ass man. I'm like, oh, like sifat lao chung. And then they looked at me blankly.
Yeah, like, what are you saying?
Yeah. And I'm like, no, sifat lao chung. And then they're like, nope.
No, that's not a something.
And they're like, what are you trying to say? And I'm like, well, I'm trying to say your rear end has worms. And they go, oh, sifat yao chung. I'm like, oh. I was like, well, what was I saying?
Yeah.
And they said, well, you were saying your ass has upper level management.
Different.
In some circles, it could be an even worse insult.
That's true.
Didn't
think about that.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, so then I had to call my mom, and I'm like, thanks, mom. You almost caused an international incident with your wrong advice.
Yeah, well, I think that your experience is very typical of heritage bilinguals, you know, kids who grow up with parents who speak another language, where they do pick up however their language that they hear around the house, whatever their input is. And sometimes it does get distorted if it gets mm-hmm. filtered through your native English mm-hmm. American ear. I'm sure my kids have very similar experiences to you when they try to say something in Romanian or Russian.
Yes.
But since we are on the topic of, again, swearing words.
Sure. Yeah. Let's continue. I love it.
Having PJ mention his experiences and the type of swearing words and what counts as a swear word, I actually just remembered a few more examples from the book. So
yeah.
Different languages focus on slightly different things in their swearing. Like you've just heard the class example in mm-hmm. Language that PJ mentioned. In English, a lot of those swear words center around sex and bodily fluids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that happens in a lot of other languages. But interestingly, in Dutch, which is a language that my kids also grew up with at home because their father speaks Dutch, he's from the Netherlands, a lot of swear words center around illnesses and diseases and sort of wishing some
really?
Illness.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And it will be interesting to see for me how some of these examples get translated into other languages when the book gets translated, because a lot of the examples are a little bit language specific.
Sure.
So curious to see how other languages handle those examples. One that's particularly, I think, interesting is I use multiple examples from Japanese. And in one part of the book, I talk about words, terms that don't translate across languages, mm-hmm. that don't have exact mm-hmm. translations. And many languages have words like that.
What inspired you to write this book? How did you come up with the concept and what drove you to write this book?
I'm glad we circled back to way for all the curse and sex words that we were about to go
into.
I mean, we were on profanity for a while,
I think it's fun, and I'm sure the listeners would enjoy some of it, but it can quickly become all about that, and we'll have a whole show about it. what inspired you to write this book? So I was born and grew up in Moldova. Moldova is a small country in Eastern Europe between Ukraine and Romania. Up until a year ago, most Americans had never heard of it. Now, unfortunately, because of the war in Ukraine, it has been in the news a lot more. As it turns out, most people of my generation in Moldova grew up with two languages. So Romanian is the national language that people speak at home usually, because Moldova was part of Romania before it was occupied by Russia, by Soviet Union, and became a Soviet republic. So Russian was the official language of the Soviet Union. So I grew up with Romanian and Russian, and then later learned English, and then later acquired a few more other languages along the way. And as a result, would often notice curious things about languages and sort of curious differences and curious patterns that I found really interesting and fascinating. And I would notice that they would sort of change in certain ways how I think about things. And I didn't really see a lot of popular science books that reflected my experience as a bilingual, as a person who grew up with two languages, who had a bilingual mind. And Toni Morrison has this quote that if there is a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it.
Perfect.
So I thought, I would love to read this book about bilingual minds. It hasn't been written, so why not write it? I think it also brings this study of bilingual and multilingual minds more into the mainstream, because for the most part, we still think about language and mind from this perspective of a monolingual person. But that's not the reality for most of the world. Most people in the world, the majority of the world's population is bilingual or multilingual. It is very common in countries all over the world to grow up with two or more languages and acquire additional languages later in life. But the experiences of these people are not very much reflected by our science, by our technology, by just really our social, public, intellectual thinking, really. And to think about language and mind and sort of humanity's mental potential without including bilinguals and multilinguals is very similar to how in the medical field people used to study heart disease or diabetes, for example, and focus exclusively on white men. We now know that in women, heart disease manifests differently. And in populations indigenous to North and South America, diabetes, sugar is processed differently. So in the same way, if we study the mind and leave out this huge segment of the population that speaks two or more languages, we're really getting an incomplete and inaccurate understanding of the human mind and of human potential. So this is where this field of psycholinguistics that does research on bilingualism and multilingualism comes in, really.
And what's so interesting, too, in the book is you also, as we mentioned earlier, get into other codes that aren't traditional language, mathematics or music and this sort of thing. How is the brain wired to use these kinds of codes? How should we think about that?
That's a really good question, because it brings us to a broader, a little bit more philosophical and neuroscientific question of what is language? And language is really at its core, a symbolic system. And what I mean by that is with language, we use symbols like words. You and I are now using words to represent our mental states, to encode an idea, communicate that idea, and then decode it. So symbolic systems can be of all sort of manner. So these are systems that allow us to transmit information, to encode it in this symbol, in the symbols, and communicate across time, communicate across space, and learn and transmit really advanced information. And in that way, language and thought sort of go hand in hand. It's hard to know what comes first. There is this debate, because The question sometimes comes up, like, how do you know if you have a thought without putting it in a word or into a language? Now, of course, we can think, well, we have thoughts that are not linguistic, and yet we kind of think about them through language. So language and thought are really very closely connected.
Yeah, yeah. And that's so interesting, too, because music, for instance, communicates so much. You can communicate sadness or happiness or a lot of different emotions in sound that, you know, you almost can't quantify in words, but you feel it when you hear it. And so that's interesting.
Right. So some might even say that music was one of the earliest form of communication. It's hard to really know. Was it language? Mm-hmm. Was it music? Was it nonverbal communication like gestures? Mm-hmm. We don't really have a record of how languages evolve. There are multiple theories, and music is definitely has been with humanity from its very beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's super interesting. So thinking about like us as parents and, you know, what should we as parents keep in mind when it comes to how our children are learning to communicate, whether that's through music or through language, and how do we help them potentially develop various languages, right? Depending on what their affinity is towards, and how do we help them develop other codes of communication?
I'm really glad you used the word affinity, and the reason I say that is because I think the most important thing we as parents can do and should do is focus on raising a happy child and support what they naturally gravitate towards, have an affinity for, like you just all have a talent for. And if that's language or one form of code of communication, maybe it's math, maybe it's music, then great. But I'm not a big fan of overscheduling and stressing out kids and having parents live through their kids or force parents' interests on them, because kids are their own people. And whether like it or not, we discover that as they grow up. So it's okay if your kids are not into what you are into and you are not into what your parents are into. I certainly am not into things that my parents are into, and my children largely have their own interests. So this is a background before going into, it's a good thing to encourage kids to learn another language, because I want to be mindful of making sure that it's not forced upon them. And if they love it, just like music lessons and lots of other things, you don't want to ruin your parent-child relationship by forcing something that the kids are just not into. But if the kids show an interest in language or in another code of communication, then supporting that and providing a safety net for them to pursue that interest and being patient with them and encouraging is really the baseline, the starting point. And then from there, I would say some of the first things is that it's never too early or too late to learn another language. If you're wondering at what age you should start teaching your child another language, I would say that the best time is from birth.
Yeah.
The second best time is now.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't really there is no critical age beyond which you can't learn another language. People used to think that, you know, there's this critical age and there was a debate. Is it 7? Is it the teenage years? Is it 14? Is it 18? Hundreds of studies on that. And really, by now, at this point, I've done so much research, and not just me, a lot of people have studied bilinguals and multilinguals and have shown that you can learn another language at any age. Now, you may retain an accent like I do when I speak English because I've learned it later in life, but that's okay. That doesn't mean that you can't learn it to fluency where you can function in it.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to know, because I think, you know, I've had some of that old philosophy or thinking, like, you know, if your brain isn't malleable, you know, like a kid or preteen, then, you know, you're never really going to reach the fluency, you know, that you might need to really communicate. So it's wonderful to learn that really any age.
Absolutely. And what's even more interesting, so for someone like you, for both of you, really, if you've been exposed to multiple languages growing up, even if you didn't learn them or learn them to fluency, it will be easier now to learn those languages. And really easier to learn new languages in general. So one of the best things parents can do for their kids is provide a really rich, stimulating environment, a rich auditory input. Have them hear lots of languages. Expose them to, because richness of input is one of the best predictors of language development. So even if your child won't become bilingual or multilingual, just exposing them to rich auditory input actively. So not just by watching TV and watching Dora the Explorer in another language, but really interacting with them in another language, is very helpful. And especially for parents who are living now in a country that speaks a language different than their native language, it is really important to support and encourage their use of the native language at home. And oftentimes teachers and clinicians don't do that and discourage that and say, no, you should only use, you know, English or whatever second language might be, because otherwise you'll confuse the child or the child will develop delays or disorders, which is not true. There is no evidence that growing up with a second or third language will confuse the child or will lead to increased incidence of delay or disorder. There is some evidence that you may have delay in early vocabulary acquisition, but kids catch up later and the benefits long-term outweigh that, but there is no increased risk of language disorder. And in fact, if you tell a parent who is not fluent in the second language to not use their native language and to only use their second language, you, in essence, are depriving the child of a rich auditory input. Because if now the parent is really told only use their second language and they're not fluent in their second language, the child will get either no linguistic input from an interaction with a parent or very limited input with limited vocabulary, limited syntax, limited topics of conversation compared to the rich auditory input they would have received in their native language. So a rich, again, to sort of repeat myself, a rich auditory input is the best thing, and a rich input in general is the best thing that parents can do for their children. Well, not best, you know, love here, but it is a good thing to provide. So,
That's wonderful, and I love that. That encouragement of having both. My, my dad's family is Japanese, and when he was growing up, he was the oldest child, and they spoke only Japanese at home, even though his parents were fluent in Japanese and English because they had been born in California, but their parents were living with them. So because the grandparents didn't know English, they spoke Japanese at home. And then when he started kindergarten, he only spoke Japanese and there wasn't that support because it was a Texas school. It wasn't in a large Japanese community and he had to catch up very quickly. They ended up taking him to a private Catholic school that at least would, try to work with him. And then he, from that point on, they only spoke English at home and really felt like they needed to not speak Japanese. And as an adult, my dad says he isn't fluent, but he knows so much about the language inherently. He went to Japan and could communicate, even though, you know, for most of his adult life, he's like, I don't know any Japanese, you know? And I think that was just so scarring from a young age that, you know, it was difficult for him. And I'm glad to see we're moving away from that.
Very slowly.
Yeah.
We are not really.
Not fast enough.
Yeah. Lots of places still do what your dad unfortunately had to experience. And that must have been a very traumatic experience for him. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
If you both have kids and I have kids. So, you know, when you drop the kids off at kindergarten, first day of school, even if they speak the language, it's traumatic.
Yes. Yes.
Like every year you drop off the kids at the elementary school and you see the moms crying and the kids crying and it's just...
It's just, so many tears.
Some kids are like, bye, see you later. But not always. Now imagine that happening and you don't speak the language and you don't understand the language. Mm-hmm. And so often teachers confound that with intelligence, with personality, and just with lots of other things. And there is this bias for sure. So we've got a long way to go from acknowledging that difference is not disorder, that a child who speaks another language has language. They just don't have, because teachers would often say, oh, I see she doesn't have language yet, or he doesn't have language yet, and have that bias. And in some states, in some geographical locations, it's worse than others. But yeah. I often get emails and messages from parents and just people who've had to experience a lot of biases as a result of their bilingualism. And you can, if you just read the news, you'd often see things. So in Texas, since you mentioned Texas, there was a case of a father not being allowed to speak Spanish with his child at the risk of losing the rights to
that's terrible
his child and have the joint custody arrangement.
Yeah,
so
it's just terrible. And you know what's interesting too, because I know in some of your research you talk about the benefits of being multilingual in terms of a lot of different things. I don't know if you want to talk about some of the benefits of being multilingual.
Yeah, sure. So that's really interesting because sometimes there are all these negative biases when in fact, knowing more than one language and having more than one code of communication is incredible for our brains. It's just such a wonderful thing. And whether you take math, whether you take music, whether you take an artificial language, whether you take a natural language, it's really an enriching experience that allows us to learn and grow in ways that we can't without that symbolic system. But if we stay just with human languages, with like two natural languages, a bilingual who, let's say, grows up with any language, any two languages, in essence, it gives your brain a constant workout because you constantly have to juggle your two languages. Mm-hmm. Like right now, when I'm speaking to you in English, I have to make sure that Romanian doesn't suddenly pop out because you don't understand that.
Yeah.
So I have to manage that, make sure that I don't suddenly start speaking in Romanian, and that when you are speaking to me in English, I map English onto meaning and don't think, well, I don't understand what this is because it's not Romanian. So your brain has this constant workout, which is unlike most other experiences that we can engage in. And in fact, there is now really exciting evidence from neurolinguistics showing that if you know two or more languages, if you are bilingual and you develop dementia, Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia, you will be diagnosed 4 to 6 years later. Mm-hmm. So the symptoms are severe enough for diagnosis 4 to 6 later than if you are monolingual.
Interesting. So it really not delays the onset, but kind of that your brain is working so hard that maybe some of the bad effects of Alzheimer's or dementia don't really manifest until later.
Right. So it gives your brain it functionally compensates for the structural and anatomical deterioration. With the same level of anatomical deterioration, you are able to function well longer.
Interesting.
So if I were to use a metaphor, for example, let's say you are driving to work and home every day and you take a certain bridge to go work and home. And then after many, many years, one day that bridge, you try to go home and the bridge is collapsed. If there are other bridges that have been built over time that you know about and you can take, that's fine. You can just take a different bridge and go home without a problem. But if that's the only bridge there is, or the only bridge you know about, you are in trouble.
Oh,
you are not going to get home, really.
Interesting.
So with bilinguals, you have another language that over time has established this rich network of connections between words and meanings and memories that allows you to retrieve information for longer and compensate for the deterioration in other places.
Oh, wow.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. And if we take it, so my book has two parts. The first half is on the self and individual, and the second part is about society. So if we take the same, since we're talking about dementia and mental and some of the cognitive decline, if you look at the level of society, there is actually some data from a population health study that shows that the incidence of Alzheimer's is lower in countries where the society knows two or more languages.
Interesting.
So countries that are monolingual, where society is monolingual, have a higher incidence of Alzheimer's. And then with each additional language, it's really a correlation that with each additional language, the incidence of Alzheimer's is lower at the national level. Yeah.
How do you get over people's reticence to learn a new language?
If they've been monolingual.
If they've been monolingual. Yes.
I imagine if Sorry. You're, yes.
Well, I would probably first want to ask, where does that reticence come from? So because I myself grew up with multiple languages, and in many other countries, people just kind of naturally grow up with multiple languages. So as I said, I grew up with Romanian and Russian. My husband grew up with Dutch and German. And also we, in Europe, you sort of learn additional languages. The grandparents speak many languages, and most people I know speak multiple languages. So I would need to really understand where that reticence comes from. Where do you think it comes from?
Well, in this particular case, I think it just comes from pure stubbornness. There's a wonderful person that I know that refuses to learn French.
Oh, that's ridiculous. I'm trying. I would like to learn Japanese. Okay, give me one thing at a time.
Your marital spat there? I have to think about how to negotiate.
No, it's totally fine.
Let's first acknowledge that there is a limited number of hours we all have in a day. So we all have to prioritize where we allocate our time. And if you have 5 kids and you're writing a book and you're running a household and you're doing podcasts, maybe it's hard to fit in learning French.
That's right. There's only so much time with Duolingo. Just saying.
Ochen hara show.
Did I take care of saying? But at the same time, I will say that there are now so many easy and fun ways to learn another language. If you're driving, for example, on Audible, I like to listen to books on Audible, but there are actually language learning lessons that you can
check out. Yeah.
Lots of different languages, and they have different programs, and you can pick it up as you are driving the kids off and dropping them to soccer and wherever else you are dropping them off. So making it easy and fun, I think, is key. Probably some of the reticence, not in Kara's case, but in other people's cases, comes from maybe thinking that it's difficult or it's hard, or maybe they had a bad experience with a foreign language teacher in school where it had to be done just right and just a certain way. And some people think, well, if I can't be perfect and great at it, I might as well not do it at all. But with language, every little bit helps. So you don't have to be fluent, and you don't have to suddenly, you know, read Camus in French, Cara. You can just learn how to order Cognigan at the restaurant when you go.
Yes.
And, you know, so just learning, starting in whatever way is most fun for you but I wouldn't now translate it into any languages.
Yeah, actually, multiple.
Exactly. So if you would try to read it in that language, you already know what the word is, so you learn it faster. Is the movie done in other languages as well?
Good question. I don't know.
I do, but I don't.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think, well,
actually, I don't know about it. I don't know about that.
The book has been in.
Yes.
Her book's been in Swedish.
But I should
look
into the movie and see. Yeah, that might be an interesting thing.
So I mixed the two titles from your two books. I Do But I Don't.
Yes.
And I did, but I wouldn't now.
That's right.
But if you watch a movie that you already know and love in another language, that also helps. So I think making it fun, a lot of the apps right now have built in what we know about neuroscience to give you that little ping of reward, get your dopamine and serotonin levels up a little bit in the brain when you get something right and make it into a game that's fun.
Yeah.
Little Pavlovian.
That's right.
Kind of thing.
Exactly.
Well, that's fun. That's amazing. So just real quick, from what I'm hearing, K-pop is a good thing for our kids then, and they should maybe learn a little Korean.
Some would say K-pop is always a good thing.
Definitely our kids would. Yeah.
It's well produced. That's right.
I think if it helps them learn another language, even a little bit, or exposes them to that, the sounds of another language, which are often different from the sounds of English, and sort of broadens their perceptual window there, then that's only a wonderful thing. And all of these languages that we mentioned today in the interview, like Mandarin and Japanese and Korean, once you learn them, you couldn't read The Power of Language in that language. So that's another reason to
that's
learn.
That's right.
It.
There you go. That's great to know.
That is great to know.
Sorry.
No worries. And just so you know, I did take Russian in college. And what I remember from that is, ochen plocha. So that's all I used to hear.
Well, watching Floja, Kara, because you probably don't know what it means, means very bad.
Yeah.
So I didn't take you for a pessimist.
The teacher was telling him that my Russian was very bad all the time. She would say ochen had a show to other people, but to me,
ochen had a show. So this must have been a bad teacher if all you remember is that.
I heard it enough, that's for sure. But
I hope you can overcome that, and I hope actually that's true for everyone who's had a lot of those negative evaluations and inputs and feedback growing up, because I mean, really, how sad is that? Because it really changes how likely we are to engage with something and to fall in love with something that's wonderful and beautiful and another language, another culture, the sound, the music, the food, the richness of what that opens up for you. To miss out on that just because the teacher was having a bad day and giving the kid the negative feedback is just heartbreaking, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had some not so great teachers. German and Russian. Right. Anyway. This has been fascinating.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful talking with you.
So very cool. Your book is going to be amazing. Yeah. We cannot wait for it to come out.
Pick it up April 4th, everyone.
It's going to be great. Yes. And we can pre-order.
Pre-order now.
All right. Awesome. Right. Amazon and everything.
Everywhere. Yeah.
Perfect. So one fun question for you is, every season we have a different question. So this season, the question is, what was your first concert that you ever went to?
That's a really fun question to think about. And in my case, I think there are two ways to answer it. First ever concert from my childhood or first American concert. Because if first American concert, because for your listeners, the Moldovan music will mean nothing. But the first American concert I went to was the Rolling Stones in Atlanta in 94.
Nice.
There you go.
And now that you're asking, I remember my first three. So it was the Rolling Stones in 94, the Indigo Girls in 95.
Love them.
Emory. I was at Emory at the time, and they were just often playing on campus. And then Pearl Jam in Buffalo in
92.
Love Pearl Jam. Seen them a few times. Oh.
What was the best concert you ever saw?
The best concert I ever saw? I'm not going to do that. It's like asking the best book you've ever read.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to narrow it down for sure.
It's hard, but it's like you love them all for different reasons at different stages of your life.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. Yeah.
And what if someone listens to this podcast and goes, well, the Rolling Stones, what about me, Paul McCartney?
Right.
Sure, Paul McCartney will listen to this.
That's right. I hope Sir Paul is listening.
If Sir Paul's listening, we will have him on free of charge anytime
he would like to come on and talk about music. That would be fantastic.
Because
I've never right. heard Paul McCartney live. I would have loved to. But since he came up, when I was in Moldova, I was often going to concerts of a Beatles cover band in the 80s at the Flying Postman. And later, they became the Black Olives, and they're now in London and in other places. So that's Paul McCartney. Oh, I'm sure he's heard them play.
That's right. Of course.
That's awesome. Oh,
that's great. Well, it's been absolutely wonderful talking with you. The book sounds fascinating. Cannot wait to read it. And, Thanks so much.
We'll have all of your social medias on the show notes so that people can follow you and reach out. We're very excited for the book to come out. We think it's going to do great. It's super interesting.
Yeah.
You are a treasure trove of information, which we really appreciate your sharing that with us.
Yeah. Keep up all the wonderful research.
Thank you. I would be saying, oh no, please, but then.
Say more, please.
Thank you. This is so kind of you and so generous. It's really been fun. And I've been a big fan of Kara's, before the first book came out. I went to your signing at Barnes & Noble that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
Early first days ever. And have loved, I think I probably have all of your books.
Oh. Well, it's been such a treat. Your friendship is wonderful, and I just love all the amazing things you're doing at Northwestern. It's just so impressive, so important.
Thank you. It's been fun talking to you both. Yeah. So thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Wasn't she great?
Oh my gosh.
I've learned so much.
Talk about being humbled. My lordy. I know. She really knows her stuff.
Yeah. And now we know, you know, get to work on learning that other language. Just
yeah.
Don't worry about what your professors or teachers said back in the day. Just get started now.
Dora the Explorer.
Yeah.
Get her in with those kids stat.
Yeah.
As well as any other influences from any other languages outside of English to your kids, because the more you expose them to it, the better they are.
That's right. That's right. Well, I almost hate to say this, but is it time? Is it dad joke time?
Well, yeah.
Oh, all right. Let's get it over with. I think you should have to do dad jokes in a different language, and then maybe they would be funnier for me.
I could try to read these.
No,
in
that's okay.
Accents.
Oh
which
no,
I'll butcher,
no. I think
I'll just
no,
destroy.
No, no. It doesn't count. Doesn't count.
Sure.
Yes, positive.
What did one wall say to the other?
I don't know.
Let's meet at the corner.
Oh, I just walked right into that.
Yes, you did. Oh, that must have been painful. Was it into a wall?
Wall, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What concert costs just 45 cents?
What?
If you go to see 50 Cent featuring Nickelback.
Oh. Oh, my God. Also, I can't imagine those two together.
That hurts
ever,
on.
Ever. It hurts on many levels. Whew.
That was a deep one. That was a deep one.
Yeah.
What
jokes that make me do math.
Oh, here's another one. What did the zero say to the eight?
I don't know.
Oh, that belt looks good on you.
Nice. Nice. I'm glad one of us is having fun. I'm glad.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, I only know 25 letters of the alphabet.
Really? Why is that?
Well, because I don't know why.
Oh, nice. And on that note,
I think you hate me a little more every time I say one.
On that note, I hope you enjoyed
the first
episode of the third season
of What the Parent. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a lot of great people on, a lot of people way smarter than me.
Yes.
This season,
so and
talking about parenting as well as so many other different really super interesting subjects.
Yeah.
So hope you enjoyed this, found it educational or at least entertaining, and check out our other episodes of our mm-hmm. podcast, and feel free to subscribe and like and share and all that fun stuff, and thanks for being a part of this. We love putting these out and hope that you guys enjoy it as well.
Yeah.
So thanks again so much for everything, and we'll see you on the flip side.
We'll see you next time.